We have a real great gift of music. We hope that you're enjoying Boston. We hope that you have savored this opportunity to hone your craft and to listen and open your ears and your hearts to the gift of music in all of its varieties and forms. We will have that tonight. And I would like to invite forward, representing our congregation, Mary Collins, who will be offering a greeting. But just before she does, I just want to say one thing before you eventually get to the sermon a little bit later in the service. And that is, in this unchurched age, a mother took her child to a service and asked her what she thought of it. She replied, "The music was great, but the commercial was too long." It's going to be mostly music tonight, and Mary will tell you a little more about our heritage and our tradition here at First Church.
Good evening. First Church in Boston was founded in 1630 when the settlers on the Arbella arrived in what is now Charlestown. The church today is made up of seven societies of merged churches, and was, at the last Boston Convention of the AGO, known as First and Second Church. We have a history rich in famous names from John Winthrop, the founder and governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, to ministers John Cotton, Cotton Mather, Charles Chauncey, and John Davenport, to William Emerson, the father of Ralph Waldo, and Edward Cummings, the father of E.E. Musically speaking, this was the church of Arthur Foote, a founding member of the AGO, Charles Zeuner, Lucien Southard, and Whitney Thayer. It continues to be the church of former music director and founder of Boston's Cantata Singers, Leo Collins, and it has, at one time or another, been a musical home for organists including Yuko Hayashi, Brenda Leach, Lee Ridgway, Thomas Handel, and Victoria Sirota. Aside from the AGO commissions of Hilary Tams and Ed Thompson's works, most of the music in tonight's service comes from composers affiliated with the First Church in Boston. Carl Henning and Larry Phillips, who harmonized the second hymn, have both sung with the choir in recent years. Carl Henning is up in the balcony there, he's singing tonight. Leo Collins, who wrote the first hymn in addition to the choral meditation, was music director from 1964 to 1997. Leo Collins, could you stand up? That's my dad. And Larry Tronsbell is a current member of the church.
As we light tonight's chalice to begin our service, these are the words that we say every week, but the choir will now share them with you in the sung evocation of our tradition.
Lord,
Thank you.
touch inward springs.
Not to bind them by ineradicable prejudices to our particular sect or peculiar notions.
But to prepare them for impartial, conscientious judging of whatever subjects may be offered to their decision.
Not to burden the memory, but to quicken and strengthen the power of thought.
Not to impose religion upon them in the form of arbitrary rules, but to awaken the conscience, the moral discernment.
In a word, the great end is to awaken the soul, to excite and cherish.
ourselves fully, completely, without measure or remorse, to these days that we have given. Offer us a steady resolve that undergirds momentary discouragement and even episodic ecstasy. Sustain in us a desire to serve and to comfort, to offer our best selves for the inspiration of many and more than we can possibly know. Make us, yes, instruments of thy peace, but also of a divine discontent for a world so needy of this care. Above all, give us joy. Joy in daily living. In mundane tasks, as well as transcendent moments, so that others can know us not as part of a plan, but as a hidden, unfolding life yet to be. And all of these gifts, we offer our thanks this night, each night. Amen. I think one of the most beautiful and evocative of the hymns in our tradition. Number 352, Find the Stillness, 352.
Thank you.
invite us into the realm of the sacred in this most immediate way. Now, you didn't come here tonight to hear much about Karl Barth, that 20th century theologian who spoke of the otherness of God and how we only know God through God's grace. But I find this rusty theologian whose weighty tomes, his volumes, 13 volumes, 9,000 pages in German of his church dogmatics, he is quite lovable when he writes and talks and shares his immediate and intimate love of Mozart. He said, it may be that when the angels go about their task praising God, they play only Bach. But I am sure, remember, that when they're there together in finale, they play Mozart. For Bart, Mozart was more than a godlike genius, as he is so often portrayed. Bart understood what is becoming clearer and clearer to those who really study Mozart, that far from Mozart transcribing the notes of heaven without scratching out a line, that he was, in fact, a hardworking, scrambling, everyday worker bee of the musician's life. And he said it all himself, although it often gets lost in the haze of Olympian romanticism that overtook his legacy after his early death. He said this, "People err when they think that my art comes easily to me. I assure you, dear friend, nobody has devoted so much time and thought to composition as I. There is not a famous master whose music I have not industriously studied through many times." Now, I have to admit, and I would like to extend this to you as a gift tonight, it is somewhat comforting to accept ourselves into this aspect of his reality. It is ludicrous to say that because we're not geniuses. But we are tied to him, thus in powerful ways. Mozart did all kinds of music and musical forms open to him, including masses and sacred music of all kinds, and even the Requiem in the last month of his life. But he also, in relationship to cardinals, kept his freedom and his own latitude throughout his musical career. Not bound or tied strictly to the past, but not in open rebellion against it either. Bart loves Mozart, not because he is orthodox. And when I share his love of Mozart with you tonight, it is certainly far more than his genius that is being shared. But rather, what Bart identified is Mozart's gift of freedom. He, first of all, gives this freedom to us. Bart said Mozart's music always sounds unburdened, effortless, and light. This is why it unburdens, releases, and liberates us. This is true even in his famous minor key compositions. He so truly mastered his craft, and always in his striving for great refinement, nevertheless managed never to burden his listeners, especially not with his creative labors. We have all heard composers who made us feel every bit of sweat that they exerted upon their composition, not Mozart. And more, Bart said that Mozart is unusual for this reason. He does not wish to say anything. He just sings and sounds. And thus he does not force anything upon the listener. He does not demand we make any decision or take any position. He simply leaves us free. But Bart then clarified why Mozart is so important to us. Because of a freedom that he claimed for himself. He said, Alfieri did not read very much. He certainly never speculated or lectured. There is no Mozartian metaphysics. In the realms of nature and spirit, he sought and found only the opportunities, materials, and tasks for his music. And with God, the world, himself, heaven and earth, life, and above all, death, ever present before his eyes, in his hearing and in his heart, sermon cannot touch. The sublime choral anthem, where you and the composer and the singers and the acoustic space and the open-heartedness of the congregation listening are in a strange and conjoined moment. And words and direction and study and knowledge and sound psychology, all these things matter. But these moments are simply grace, and they are far beyond our clattering words. Toscanini was once doing a presentation of Debussy's Lumiere, and he wanted to achieve an especially quiet and evocatively spiritual effect in one passage. And his vocabulary in English was very limited, and he was at a loss for words. So he paused, and he took out a large white silk handkerchief from his breast pocket, and he threw it high into the air. And the orchestra just watched in silent amazement as it floated softly, sensuously down to the floor. There, he said, play like that. And if in these times of upheaval, in the world of organized religion, you were ever tempted to inwardly surrender and think that worship somehow doesn't matter, that your essential freedom as an artist doesn't count. Hear this. F. Murray Abraham, who played Solari in the movie Amadeus, said after the production, "I believe Solari must have responded to Mozart the way most artists do, with amazement, humility, envy, and finally with gratitude. For in the end, the source of creation is available to all of us. And to those blessed with genius, they're only messengers, bringing good news to an otherwise dark and at times unbearable world." Someone once went up to Robert Shaw after a production of Bach's Mass in B minor. He said to Shaw, "You know, what we're doing tonight really matters, because it's tonight, somewhere in the audience, it is the first time they have ever heard it. Be thou that wintry sound by which sorrow is released. Dismissed, absolved, in a starry placating, we may return to Mozart. He was young and we are old. The streets are fully of cries. Be seated, thou. In this earthly realm, I greet you, and I thank you. Be seated, and strike the piercing chord. Amen.
Thank you. in this fellowship a sense of the wonder and joy